Hello. Welcome to EMF, by the way. If you've been around all week, like some of us have been, it's been great to see people come and set up. As I was introduced, my name's Nick Whitehead. This talk is on how roadies and live touring have had to adapt to become network engineers. I work in the live event industry, predominantly in touring and concerts, festivals, sometimes some more interesting broadcast projects. And my specialism is in lighting and video control systems. But through my work with my previous employer, Adlib, I have ended up being involved with a lot more. And so I've been doing project management and working across lighting, video, and audio, as well as some more production management and setting up of events. Quick disclaimer, this isn't a deep dive into the specifics of protocols and AV networks, although we are going to talk about that. But it's more of a broad look at some of the technologies and where it's come from. Firstly, what is a roadie? That's what Google thinks we are. There is a huge array of job roles and different departments and specialisms within the industry, but the broad term for what we are, according to the world, is a roadie. There's a song by Tenacious D about us, and there's also an awful American TV show about roadies as well. Quickly, would anyone here describe themselves as a roadie? Put your hand up. Cool. Does anyone work in related industries such as broadcast, theatre, sports presentation? Cool. And has anyone ever been to an event, gig, or festival? Everyone's hand should be up because you're at one right now. Remarkably, EMF is run by entirely volunteer run by a team who don't just work over the 2 weeks of build and tear down, but year round between both events. It's hard enough to make events work with full-time staff where it's their job to make things happen and they get paid to do it. So the fact that everyone here works on it for free is amazing. So if you see any of the organizing team, any of the volunteers, please say thank you. So just going to do a little bit of brief history of where live touring came from. Predominantly in what we would call live touring these days dates back to kind of the 50s and the 60s with rock and roll. Bands such as the Beatles were very fundamental in kind of global touring. They were one of the first bands to tour all over the world and play stadiums and shows all over the place. But they were also involved with technological advancements, because before that point, and the bands around that era, that there wasn't a front of house engineer, sound man, there wasn't a monitor engineer, and all these different roles kind of spawned from kind of that era in the 50s and 60s. Interestingly, rock and roll defines a music genre, but it also defines our industry really well, because they were rocking and then they were rolling to the next city, venue, wherever. So audio kind of started developing in the 60s, 50s, 60s. It wasn't until the late 60s that kind of lighting technology started to take on. There had been predominantly a lot of use of theatrical lighting, but in a trend we're going to talk about more, the industry borrowed from other industries, and things such as par cans and lighting came about. Initially at 110 volts and then later in 240 volts, at big stage shows like the Queen stage show that's on the screen now, the entire lighting rig is made up of par cans, which was a cheap fixture that was easy to match produce. Also around the 60s and 70s, a lot of the common brands that still exist to this day were starting to be formed, such as Martin Audio, Allen Heath, and Avalite. All of those companies exist today at some of the highest levels in the industry. And those companies are all British. There is a lot of technology companies for our industry that are based from England, the United Kingdom, and have spread all over the world as leaders in the technology that makes our industry happen. Talk quickly about borrowing from other industries. That is a Socapex connector, which is initially designed for military and aviation use. 19 pins, and it's used to transport 6 discrete main circuits to lighting equipment, or sometimes used in motors for three-phase power or audio. Designed for military and aviation, not used in military and aviation anymore, but used across the entire industry and distribution. There's a quick side note. There's probably a talk on electrical temporary installations for live events for someone to do at EMF. I'm not the person to do it because I didn't pay attention to BS 7909, which is the temporary wiring regulations. But it's very interesting how temporary power, it follows the rules of the UK wiring specification, but it also bends them at the same time. So if any of you out here did BS 7909 and understand its full implications, there'll be a great talk there. So carrying forward, audio is not my specialism, so in this talk I'll try and give you as much information as I can, but predominantly it's in lighting and video. So in the 80s, moving lights, which are fixtures that can be moved and set up, started to come around. It's developed by a US company called Varilight, who existed because the band Genesis saw their prototype and went, have a load of money, we want to tour with these. Initially programmed using RS-422 of all things. And then finally, we'll get to video. Video started a lot later than the other parts of the industry. We're looking at like U2's Pop Mart tour in 1997, one of the first people to use LED displays as we know them today in live concert touring. So one of the things that happened around the 90s is computers became readily available for everyone. And our industry that we love borrowing and stealing from other places just started using them everywhere. So you can see on your right, one of the early Grand MA lighting consoles. Fundamentally looks and does very much the same thing today because it's based on a computer and they just evolve over time. And because of this computerization of all products from audio processing, lighting control, video playback, networking suddenly became something that could be really utilized for redundancy, backup, and creating networks that allow different products to talk to different things. There is a little bit of FPGA usage as well, predominantly in video, because video is very hard, and we'll get to that bit towards the end, but are also used in kind of audio processing. But because of the nicheness of our industry, it's not worth the development time on an FPGA-based system. And yeah, so networking kind of allows us to create these robust systems where we can have backup control systems and backup control systems and backup and share signals between different products. And one of the things that, when I keep talking about backup and redundancy, is concert touring is hard. I don't want to, this isn't a woe, this is me, I have a hard job, because it's a great job. I love my job. I get to go to places, and it's brilliant. But we're also working long hours. The show must go on, which is something that is very important. Look at the Co-op Live in Manchester recently. The amount of delays and postponements involved with that cost millions of pounds. The show must go on. And the amazing thing is we're going into arenas on a daily basis. We might be going on into stadiums every couple of days on a tour with a big band. And we're taking everything. We're taking not just the lights, the video, the audio, we're taking the rigging, we're taking the staging, catering, production, radios. The entire world of what we do moves every day. Just as a quick example, a tour I was on at the beginning of this year, reasonably sized UK and EU arena tour. We had 9 trucks of equipment, 6 tour buses with up to 14 people each, 30 engineers and crews, 6 caterers, 15 dancers, an A party of around 15 people. We spent a week in that studio doing rehearsals where we just sat and made the show happen. In each venue, we would utilize 40 local crew, 12 local riggers, and up to 10 local support staff covering all sorts of different areas, including runners, and then the greater venue staff such as merchandise and stewarding. We were doing that up to 5 times a week in 5 different venues. So it just goes to show that what we're traveling with, the equipment that we're trying to use, we need to make as robust and as hardened as possible. This slide is blank because I was meant to put a photo in it. But reliability and robustness is something that's really key to doing it, because we want to produce the same show day after day after day. If you can see us, if you can see a roadie, it usually means something's gone wrong, and that's not good. So I'm just going to cover broadly the three kind of core departments, being lighting, audio, and video, and kind of how we use networking and some of the kind of benefits of different ways we do what we do. I'm going to start with lighting, which is a very low bandwidth in what we do, and go all the way to video, which is stupidly high bandwidth. And that also follows lighting being the simplest and video being the most complicated. So I'm going to talk about lighting first. Lighting has actually had probably the longest running protocol that we have within our industry now, which is DMX 512, which stands for Digital Multiplexing Fire. I don't get the rest of it. It's run over XLR, 5-pin. One universe of DMX contains 512 control channels. Each control channel can have 250-bit value, so you can then create a dimmer over those 255 bits. But then fixtures are getting more and more complicated. They can move, they can tilt, they can strobe. Thank you. And so you can also link channels together. So you could use two channels, use both 255-bit values to create a 16-bit value, or vice versa with a 24-bit value across three channels. And it's inherently really stupid simple protocol. It's 250 kilobits, and there's about roughly 30 to 40 frames of DMX per second, which means you can update that light's position dimmer up to 30, 40 times a second. Whether it will actually achieve it that quickly is another thing. It, in theory, only uses two wires and is a serial protocol, half duplex, asynchronous. There's a bit of a bolt-on standard which works across those same two wires, which is remote device management, which allows you to talk to the light. Don't know why you'd ever want to talk to a light, but you can get errors and different kind of information off of it, and you can also program it from there. I did just jump over a little bit. When I was talking about DMX channels, you would tell that you would address the light to what channel it's listening to, and so a dimmer might listen to one channel, but a moving light may listen to 50, or a really stupid light might listen to 200 channels, and at which point you can only fit two lights on that universe of data. So we're talking about a bus system. That's really dumb for a talk about networks. So we have to then be able to transport multiple universes of DMX, and that's where the networking element comes into it. As a quick aside, that was Eurovision from this year. 700 universes of lighting. If we do some quick maths at 250 kilobits, that's less than 200 megabits a second of data to control that entire lighting rig, which is sort of absurd in terms of how low spec that is compared to some of the other protocols we're going to talk about later. And it's common for gigs and different concerts to be using multiple universes of data, so anywhere between 10 and 50 is probably fairly common. Big events over 100 universes, which essentially means you're getting 100 of 512 control channels. So there are two commonly used protocols for distributing lighting over a network. Both of them basically do the same thing. Most products support both of them, and at one point or another you could probably bin one of them off and no one would actually notice. But we have ARTnet by Artistic License that was initially produced in 1998. And that works as either a broadcast or unicast data, or streaming ACN, ACN standing for Architectural for Control Networks, great name, from 2006, which is a multicast protocol. That is basically the only difference in what they do. Yes, there is some back-end differences in how they work and how they talk to each other. Everything else, both protocols support. Shout out to Ash, who I think is at the back of the room, because the other day I was setting up some ArtNet down at Null Sector, and I put in a 2.0.0.0 IP range. And he went, why on earth are you doing that? There's actually, I had to go and look into the spec, because I am initially not a network engineer. It's become part of my job. And yes, that is really weird that we're using a 2.IP range for ARPANET, but it's within the initial spec. They support all IP ranges now, so you can go whatever. But the only thing they really say is because it's a Class A network. Don't ask me about that one later, because it still makes no sense to me. What their document says is it should only be used on closed networks. Don't ask the site lighting team about that one, because all their ARPANET is everywhere. SACN, again, very similar feature set. Neither of them really care about timing. You've only got 40 packets of data a second, and that's quite a broad range of how, that's 25 milliseconds in which you may want to receive that data. So latency in lighting in the network protocols and synchronization isn't really thought about. But if you're anywhere over kind of 50 milliseconds, the guy pressing the button is probably going to notice. So a simple topology for that would be you'd have the lighting console. That would then get plugged into the network, send its ARPANET or streaming ACN data over the network. It will then come out to a node, which is a device that can take ARPANET or SACN and output it to that 5-pin DMX line. And then that would go to the fixture. You would do that for all your strings of lights. The lights can be daisy chained. So for example, down this room might be a universe of lighting in the air, and it's just all linked light to light. The lighting is really basic in the grand scheme of things from a network point of view. Oh, yay. Why is this crashed? This is going great. Hey, there we go. So audio. Disclaimer again, this is not my specialty. There are people who can talk far more about audio networks at you. In the grand scheme of things, it's again not using much data, but we are now starting to think more about specifics of timing and quality of data that appears. Very simply, a microphone, a guitar, the radio mic that I'm talking into will come out on an XLR cable, and we will input that into a box that converts it into the digital realm of audio. That will then go to the mixing desk, maybe through some processing, back to the amplifiers and to the speakers. This is great having something physical to demonstrate it with. So some key elements we need to think about in audio. There's three kind of main areas that define the signal that we need to get sent. So the first is sample rate. This is the number of audio samples per second. One of the most common sample rates is 48 kilohertz, but there are a couple of others like 41.5. You could double it to 96. Your bits, bit depth, which is your bits of data per sample. So it's how much data each one of those 48 kilohertz samples can have. And again, there's common standards of 16, 24, or 32. If anyone's ever worked in music production or recording, this is probably really basic understanding to you. And then from that, we can get the bit rate. How many bits per seconds calculated by multiplying the bit depth and the sample rate. So again, some maths, 48 kilohertz at 24 bits, that's about 1.15 megabit a second. So even for this audio stream from this microphone, there is not a lot of data going around our network, but it is a bit more juicy than the lighting network. Sorry. So we're now dealing, though, with precision, because we need to make sure those samples arrive across the network in sync with each other. So that's where we go and start looking using network-style synchronization like PTP, PTB V2. A couple of common standards, AES-67, Dante, and AVB. Again, not my specialty. To me, they all do the same thing, but there are some differences in network architecture and how they were put together. Core difference being, though, that AVB and AES-67 are both open standards, where Dante is not, and you have to license the hardware to produce it. However, Dante, I'm told, is far simpler to use and also appears in a lot more devices because they've made a product that is really simple to put together. Compared to lighting, when we're talking about a protocol from the 90s and the network protocols from the early 2000s, all three of those protocols have come out in the last 20 years. We were talking about latency before. All three of those standards will deem a maximum of about 4 milliseconds, with AVB saying a maximum of 2 milliseconds for the data path. I'm told by people I work with that there really isn't actually that much benefit between them. Different manufacturers have gone down different routes, but also, like your audio console, they might produce cards for all three network types. Quickly, just going to talk about bespoke networking products before we get on to video. There's a couple of products out there. A company called Luminex seem to be the ones who have taken the key. I believe it's a D-Link at its core. I might be wrong there. And they've written their own software over the top. But more recently, Netgear have come out with some AV line products. The interesting thing about Netgear is AV Lines department have more people working for it than Luminex, and thus we've ended up with a product that's developed really rapidly within the last 5 or 6 years. It's also been dumbed down, because every day you don't want to be configuring Cisco switches, you don't want to be talking command line to your network switch. So there's a whole load of terminology that just been ripped out. VLANs are now called groups. RLinkX is what we would call rapid spanning, what wrapping spanning tree is. There's a whole bunch of simplicities. Possibly too dumb, and I'm going to indict myself here. This is at about 20 past midnight, and I text my friend Dave, who's sat there. He is an actual network engineer, but he works in live events. And I've just said I've locked myself out of a switch. I did that by assigning the same VLAN group to every port on that switch, including the management port. Yeah. It was 20 past midnight, so I'm probably doing a long night there. He found that so funny that Dave also does the training for Luminex, and so this is now in the training manual. Anyway, so quickly going to talk about video, because I realize I'm running out of time quicker than I thought I was going to be. Video are the bandwidth hoovers. We are not just talking megabits, we're talking gigabits, tens of gigabits, hundreds of gigabits of data a second. If we use SMPTE's 3G SDI, which is currently the most common standard for moving video around between cameras and different things, one stream of 1080p 50, which is your usual HD kind of video, 50 frames a second progressive, is about 2.97 gigabits a second. And going up to the 4K variant, that's 12 gigabits a second. So all of a sudden, we've jumped from dealing with kilobits and megabits of data to dealing with gigabits. And up until very, very recently, a lot of that video distribution has been taken off of networks. Their hardware within networks just wasn't there, readily available to move that much data around that quickly. I'm clearly clicking on something that takes me out of Keynote here. Sorry. I should probably not have a small rant about video equipment because I'm already running out of time, but in essence, in the video industry, no one is thinking directly of us. At one end, in live events, at one end you've got SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers, who produce standards for TV. And TV is not a live event. We work with different resolutions, we work with different frame rates and all sorts. At the other end of the industry is basically a gaming laptop, hardware designed for real-time rendering of media. We sit somewhere in the middle, and it's really annoying because no one makes products directly for video engineers in live events. It's all somewhere out here and somewhere out here, and we're combining it in the middle, which is why my laptop has to go into a converter, run off a 12-volt USB power supply to get into that projector. There's just not really a good molding. That rant, if you want to hear the full story of it, come find me later. Two kind of main video IP standards have come out, one more at the consumer end being Mutex NDI and one being at the highest end at broadcast, which is SMPTE's 2110. SMPTE's 2110 really cares about signal integrity and about synchronization, because they have to. They are converting their video signals that have existed for the last 30, 40 years in television into a network-based product. NDI, however, they don't really care. And it's very consumer. They've allowed the likes of Windows, Mac, and PC developers to use NDI within software. It's easy to send NDI across your network. The difference is in their compression. NDI, 1080p 50, your normal HD television, less than 300 megabits a second. That SMPTE 2110 is copying its 3G SDI standard, and so it is at 3 gigabits a second. You then have to have controllers because you're now routing a large amount of data around the network. NDI have done this using Bonjour, and SMPTE 2110 uses NMOS controllers. It also works at the level 2 end, so this is a bit beyond what I know, but essentially you're living in a world above level 3 IP addresses. Are we using them? Network video protocols, yes and no. This gig here was something I did last year. We had 3 4K outputs, the LED, 8 cameras used for the main mix, 4 reference cameras and 2 HD mixers were produced. If you put that into its network standard, that's 78 gigabits a second. Now, the company that I used to work for, we don't have switches that can deal with that. They are now doing installs, which go at 300 gigabits a second, but those installs are a world away from what we're trying to do on a daily basis. But it is coming. Eurovision this year, they use SMPTE 2110 for the entire pipeline of media servers to output on screens and for also doing internal routing of multi-viewers and reference feeds throughout the venue. So it is coming. Sorry, I quite rapidly got through that last bit, but yes, so SMPTE 2110 is going to become a thing. It's just right now, it's still not easy to use. Hello. It's very complicated. I'll just hold this for now. I'm not a sound engineer, but if you see any of these guys working, they have been here all week. Everyone's worked really hard around here, and things do go wrong, as we've just demonstrated. What am I doing at EMF then? This was in 2018 down at Sybar. It was a container full of screens. I'm doing something else at Sybar this year, but you'll have to wait and go and explore it for yourself later on this evening and over the weekend. There's a couple of other talks I just want to point out because they are related. Later on tonight, Seb Lee is doing a talk about his programming of lasers and the software that he's written for lasers. Very cool. I don't want to touch lasers because I feel like I could really easily hurt someone, but the people in the laser community are very, very safe. And then tomorrow, there is a talk by Morgan Hill, which delves more into the security implications of some of the network protocols that we deal with. That was quite abridged. Merging two talks that were an hour long into half an hour wasn't the greatest idea. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to talk, come and find me.